Hi folks, Russell Wright from ThemeZoom.com, and I'm incredibly excited about this interview. This is an interview with Dr. Glenn Livingston. Hi Glenn.
Hi Russell, how are you?
Excellent. I've talked a little bit about Glenn inside the forum and other calls with our members at ThemeZoom, and the reason I'm so excited about this interview is we've talked from the very beginning about market research-driven keyword research, and the fundamental confusion that most of my students have is the difference between market intelligence and keyword research. And since this is one of my cornerstone teachings, and I found somebody who taught very prolifically along those same lines, I didn't feel like I was alone anymore in trying to bring those concepts to market. And I have to say, when I sat down and watched pretty much, what would you say, is there about 18 hours of DVDs in your package?
There's 41 hours of material in the package.
Something like hour 20, I started to realize that you really have a huge amount of expertise in the area of market intelligence. So let's talk a little bit about your background.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about where you came from. And obviously, I'm on your website, which is your corporate site. And it says you have a PhD in clinical psychology.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I actually come from a family of 17 psychologists, my mom and my dad and my sister and my uncle, my aunt. And you really don't want to come to a family reunion.
Plus, you have a background in market research on top of that.
Yeah, I didn't really plan that. Like everybody, I kind of fell into it. I was in graduate school, and I fell in love with a woman who was a marketer. She was actually a focus group moderator for large companies. And long story short, I had to teach a course in graduate school to get through called the Multivariate Modeling of Human Behavior, which sounds really fancy, but what it meant was that we were figuring out how to encode things that were traditionally just part of empathic perception, the real guts of relationships, and how to put those into predictive formulas. And Sharon was doing focus group research for large companies, and what she specialized in, because she was a sexologist also, was understanding the types of motivational thoughts and feelings people had that got attached to product features. It was all very qualitative and artistic and really quite beautiful, but when the research was done, Procter & Gamble or Bausch & Lomb, where someone was going to roll out a $10 or $20 million advertising campaign, they would say, but we want numbers. Traditionally, the way that numbers were put onto those types of findings were with checklist survey type things. So check off the 7 reasons why you use the American Express card. It just eliminated all of the soul of things. And I got involved in developing protocols where you didn't have to ask people directly and you could observe and infer what was motivating them to purchase. And so then I wound up doing a lot of corporate consulting too. I hope that wasn't too long-winded an answer.
No, that's incredible. Basically, you brought a lot of emotional intelligence to the very sterile survey processing.
Yeah, emotional intelligence with a quantitative base.
With a quantitative base. That's really, honestly, right up my alley. I mean, I just love behavioral research, and I've talked a lot about it with my group, that there's been a lot of discussion lately about behavioral indexing rather than just keyword indexing or just market intelligence in general. And, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about how Amazon is really the first online organization to really track effectively and have a massive database of why people buy things emotionally, and people who purchase this also purchase very similar to the stuff that you talked about in your DVDs.
People vote with their wallet ultimately. Part of what I talk about in my DVDs is that I think that there are really 4 quadrants of marketing research, 4 different angles you can take when you're trying to understand purchasing behavior. And I think a large part of what you need to look at is what people do, because there's always a gap between what people say and what they do. And so I would never want to discount that as part of thoroughly researching a market, but I've actually found a path to power which does initiate with what people say. Because, like, let's say you're split testing 2 different variations of a sales letter, and you find that that one headline does better than the other one. Well, what you don't know is, what specifically was it about the headline that made it do better? What conversation or like our typical story are you matching in the person's head that is really pulling in their heartstrings? And
yes,
what's the best place for you to go next?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, why does one word increase sales by 30 to 50%? It's incredible.
Right. One answer to that is, who cares? Just put up the word.
Exactly. I do, though.
The second answer, Russell, is if you put it up and you get the 30% response, but you really know why it worked better, well, you can then propagate that mood and tone and that message across all of your marketing.
That's basically our philosophy as well. Interesting. I'm going to move on to one of these questions. Tell me about a few of the markets that you're into so that the teams and members can kind of get a feel for transition from your corporate, obviously pretty high-end experience with survey and psychology, and then bridge the gap for us to how you got involved with the online internet marketing community. And one of your DVDs, I saw the number of niches that you're actually covering, and joking around, I would not really want to be competing with you. Anybody who's seen your survey system and seen your overall market intelligence or niche mining system would know what I'm talking about. I wouldn't want to be anything other than in a joint venture with you.
I appreciate you saying that. And one of the things I found is that it actually helps me to be public because people do approach me for joint ventures. And
What are you working on now, and what is your favorite market, or what are the favorites that you're in now?
Okay, I'll complete the transition, and I'll tell you why I was particularly interested in joint venturing with you and coordinating with what you're doing in ThemeZone, to the best of my understanding, and how I wind up in all of these niches, and why I don't really think of myself as a niche marketer overall that everybody else does. So the short story, how did I get from being a psychologist and working as a corporate consultant to being an internet marketing guy and running all these niches, is 2001. I was doing corporate consulting and had a very full practice, and I kind of wound up specializing with suicidal adolescents. And what both of my jobs had in common was they were both extraordinarily high risk. You're doing a job for Bausch & Lomb, which is going to hopefully become the universal platform across countries for them, and they're really relying on you to give them some solid advice. You do a lot of research beforehand, and when you're working with somebody suicidal, you spend an awful lot of time researching exactly what they're thinking and feeling, and what support systems that they have, and what's led them to this point, and what are they trying to accomplish, and where do they feel frustrated. And you research before you make a move, before you make any recommendations at all.
Right.
And I was doing very well in both of those endeavors. I never lost anybody, and I had all these corporate clients, and I got kind of a swelled head. And just before 2001, my wife and I decided to invest everything we had into a high-tech conference center, which was tied to the focus group industry, which is itself tied to the airline industry.
Right.
And we didn't do any research.
So
not only did we deal with the 2001 crash of the airline industry because of what happened on 9/11, but we had spent way too much and had way too much overhead on a monthly basis to really make it profitable in the first 3 years. And I found out that it's possible to lose $2 million if you only put up a few $100,000. I didn't know that well. The gist of it is that I wound up with this opportunity to remake myself. And I said to myself, okay, I had to take a sabbatical from my practice, and I had to manage a big crisis, and when it was all over and I could remake myself, I said, what I really want to do is kiss all my clients goodbye, because as much fun as it was, corporate consulting, it kind of ate me alive.
You know,
they fly back and forth to Japan for a day, and no matter how much they paid me, it wasn't enough to live that lifestyle. And as much as I loved being a clinical psychologist, the truth was that I was kind of exhausted worrying about all my patients all the time. And I said, well, what if I could take the depth of understanding I've achieved in all the years of this psychological and consulting work and develop my own products and services? And what if I could work out on the internet so that they're all automated systems and I leave this dollars for hours world behind me? You know, the internet dream. And I went out and I hired Jonathan Mizell and Perry Marshall, and I just started paying for coaching from the best people that I could find. And they said that, why don't you take your SERP knowledge and start researching some of these keyword niches and see if you can use the survey them and then sell them model to go out and dominate some of the niches. And that's how I wound up doing this. So I would look for niches with, at first, not a lot of competition, and then as I got more confident, more and more competition, and started with guinea pigs, and people know me as a guinea pig dude online, and
definitely
built that up to a couple of thousand a month, and I got the rabbits, did the same thing, and pygmy goats. And then I was going into one niche after another, first with small animals, and then with large expensive animals like alpacas, and and then I wanted to see if I could make this work across a variety of unrelated markets like body language and Sudoku and wastewater management and disability and life coaching. And at that point, I was kind of getting excited that it wasn't so much about the niches and what the niches were doing for me, although, you know, I was doing a few hundred thousand dollars a year by that point. It was exciting to me to see the formula developing, because I was drastically enhancing what people might know as the underachiever method online, which, by the way, I think Frank Kern and Ed Dale are some of the best educators, particularly for newbies, about the survey and selling process around. But there are 20 things that you can borrow from the world of professional marketing research in the that large companies are doing, and from the world of psychology research, there are 20 things that you can do to put that on steroids squared, and that's what I did.
Yeah, definitely you do. Interesting. Let's just jump right into where what you do and what I do overlap. Let's take a look at keywords as opposed to market intelligence. Did you have an experience when you first got online and you first started working with Perry and Jonathan and some of these heavy hitters and super affiliates? Did you immediately grasp that the internet marketing didn't really have a grasp on market research in the larger sense, but confused keyword research for market research?
It's actually something that I feel that you are clarifying for the market as a whole, and something that I'm just coming to understand more recently. I can tell you that I've always known that there is a difference between the intelligence behind a keyword and the keyword itself. There's information in every keyword that people type, but the conversation in people's head behind the keyword is what's most powerful from a marketing perspective. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Like, I'm going to quote something that you said in one of your videos verbatim, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because I thought it was incredibly powerful. You said in a unique way what I have been talking to my students about, and my clients as well. You said that, and this is you talking on the video, the key difference between what I do and search engine optimization is that most marketers, when they gather keywords, are looking for keywords with the least competition. They try to gather thousands of long-tail phrases and keywords that have little competition so they can get traffic without spending a lot of money. And then you went on, well, I think that is really important to have these keyword sets in your inventory, but you're going to miss out on the whole search continuum if you do only that. And you also went on, and with this intelligence, you can make money with the keywords that are more competitive. So your guideline then, as you went on, is to look for a deep focused, comprehensive set of keywords in a fairly tightly focused set or group.
Yeah.
Let's get a little bit into this search continuum thing, because I think it's really fascinating. Can you encapsulate what you're talking about through all your videos and your body of work, what the search continuum is?
Boy, I think we could talk for hours about this whole concept right here.
That's what I'm hoping.
Okay. Let's start out by just dimensionalizing and giving a better example about what I mean when I say that there's a conversation behind every keyword, because
absolutely.
I found in my research that there can be dramatic differences between things that seem like they're just the same. And when I was a psychologist and I'd be working with suicidal people, there were two different ways that people could present that they were feeling suicidal. One was, hey doc, I'm thinking about killing myself and I wanted to talk it over. And of course you take that very seriously, and by the way, as a legal disclaimer, this is not advice about how to be a psychologist. But I found that when people would say, I'm thinking about killing myself and I want to talk it over, that there was thought involved and they were not really ready to kill themselves, but it was a thought that was scaring them, and they felt like it was possible to reason their way out of the problem. There must be a solution.
Sure.
That's why they came for help. But if somebody came in and said, hey, doc, I'm afraid I might kill myself, well, that was someone that was much, much closer to action.
And right.
The family involved and everything. And so the reason I'm saying that is because you'll find keywords that are different by one letter or one participle or something like that that have dramatically different conversations behind them. Like someone searching for guinea pig, for example, is probably looking to find out what a guinea pig is, what it looks like, where does it come from, how big do they get, that kind of thing. Whereas if they're searching for guinea pigs, plural, they are more likely to be searching for how long they live, and do they bite, and are they good with kids. And they're a little further along towards investigating guinea pigs and thinking about having them.
Right.
And that leads me to the concept of the search continuum, because if you do what I said, then you really develop a comprehensive, focused, deep set of keywords, and you survey each keyword, you drive it to a page in such a way that you can link the survey back to the keyword that it came from, you will find out what the various conversations are behind all the keywords, and there are ways that you can tell how people are progressing from keyword to keyword to keyword. So in the guinea pig example, maybe someone searches for guinea pigs, and they're looking for the basics that we talked about, and then they search for guinea pigs, and they're a little more involved and want to know how long they live, and is it okay for their kid, and do they bite, and that kind of thing. And then they maybe start to get more interested, and they search for guinea pig care, to find out what's specifically involved in caring for them, or
right.
Guinea pig cage and how to build a cage, and then they get more involved, and then they think about where do you buy a guinea pig or where do you find a guinea pig to rescue, buy a guinea pig or guinea pig rescue. And it's a very simplistic example, but they're moving from guinea pig at the beginning of the continuum all the way up to buy a guinea pig at the end.
This is excellent.
Here's why this is so critical. The first is that there are characteristics of the keywords at the beginning of the searching continuum that make them more desirable to target, if you can make it work, than characteristics at the end. At the end of the continuum, they're much closer to being ready to buy. People would say, well, why don't you want to just target the keywords at the end of the continuum, like buy a guinea pig? And of course, you do target those. But that's what every other marketer is saying, and every other marketer doesn't want to do the work of bringing people from the beginning to the end. They want to wait.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so if you're waiting until they get to the end of the continuum, you're going to pay a price for that.
Yep.
It'll be much harder to compete. And this can be the difference. In guinea pigs, it's not dramatically different. It's like a 4x difference from the end of the continuum to the beginning. But this could be the difference between 5-cent clicks and $1 or $2 clicks online if you're talking about a pay-per-click environment.
Sure.
And so if you can get them at the beginning, you can take them off the market. You can take them out of the competitive environment by...
That's correct.
If you know exactly what to present to them, take them out of the competitive environment, and then you, since you've studied the continuum so thoroughly and you know all the questions that they're going to be asking, you can develop a bond with them by slowly gripping on them with the answers to the questions that they're percolating in their mind already. They start to feel like you're psychic, and you got them for much less money, and the thing is that anybody who's looked at the distribution of keywords in a focused, deep, comprehensive market knows that the keywords at the beginning of the continuum, like guinea pig, occur in much more volume. So you get cheaper keywords, you get much more voluminous leads, you take people off the market, and then you develop this bond with them where they feel that you've saved them the time and energy and frustration of having to search for everything they need to know about the guinea pig, and voila, you've got a much more profitable marketing process, and very often you have a way to get into a market when nobody else can.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it's a new concept for me, although I think that we have models at ThemeZoom that emulate it and are similar to it. What you're telling me is that the kinds of words and terminologies that people use in the beginning of the buying cycle, in the beginning educational phases of researching something, when you grab those, you're able to, if the information is high quality enough, even emotionally intelligent or surgically targeted to their needs, then you have the chance of basically keeping them through the educational process and ultimately leading to a sale as their keywords evolve and change towards refined questions, asking the right questions.
I'll give you a more profitable example.
Okay.
Let's say you were trying to get into the migraine headache market, and there's a headache medication, Perry Marshall talks about this, called Imitrex, and it's kind of a miracle pill, and for a lot of people, it just takes headaches right away, and I think it's something like $5 a pill. Wouldn't you know that if you're bidding on the word Imitrex, that's going to be several dollars a click, $5 a click, because it's easy to sell a continuity program on it, and so it's very, very, very difficult to compete in the migraine headache market if you're going to go right for the words at the end of the continuum, like Imitrex or even migraine headache medication, because those are being typed by people who already are looking specifically for Imitrex or migraine headache medication. Okay, you could go a step down the continuum and look for migraines. That's still kind of expensive because there's a lot of pain involved with migraines, and marketers know that, and there's a lot of competition around that. But the word headache is not that expensive to target. So if you understand the process that people go through when they first start researching how to solve their migraine headaches, and you can figure out how to ferret out those people, then you can take them off the market when they're first typing in headache, maybe 20 or 30 cents a click, and be selling them these $5 pills, which everybody else is trying to compete for $5 traffic for. So that's what I mean.
Excellent. That's really a real similar model that we have. It's almost like a sideways model of what we're doing with siloing. I find it really fascinating because you do most of this kind of surveying through pay-per-click model, correct?
I do.
So you're basically using Word Tracker and using other keyword research tools, creating a cluster of keywords, and basically setting up a fairly intense, it's got to be above a certain amount of frequency or high volume query on that keyword.
Well, I actually have a couple of questions for you,
okay,
if you don't mind, because this is an opportunity for me, me to learn, because I think I feel vulnerable to relying on Word Tracker primarily, and lately I use Keyword Discovery. And
sure, yeah, those guys are great. We have relationships with several keyword research tools out there, and yeah, everybody provides different kinds of data for different reasons.
So the focus that I've had is on the conversation in people's heads and how do you get the information from each keyword. And then also we'll talk more about segmenting and other things you can do.
You bet.
But I'm always basing that on a focused and deep market that I research via Word Tracker and Overture and Keyword Discovery. And now I'm starting to understand in the last month or two when I'm looking at your work and I see something from Jeff Johnson also, that really there is a whole cadre of keywords in any niche that I'm really missing in the long tail. Mm-hmm. That I'm not really getting from Keyword Discovery and Word Tracker, and that if I were to be including the search engine synonyms and really following your method, that I would integrate that with what I'm doing, you know, on the front end to have a much more comprehensive keyword list, and I would probably have markets that were 50%, 100% more profitable. So,
yeah, well, I have to say that when myself and a staff member watched your videos, you kind of blew our minds and some stuff. You're way more educated us in just market segmentation and just market intelligence. That's what you do professionally. And while I have a background, I'm a member of a market research firm. That's kind of their token SEO and keyword person. You brought some things to the table which really helped expand. We actually had a meeting independently on some things that we can add to kind of integrate, to take the basic knowledge of what it is that you're trying to do and how you use pay-per-click. Because now that we have the pay-per-click bid management system being integrated with GameZoom, we realize that whenever you automate a module or take some of your methods into a software, that would be an ideal way to use a bid management system. But, yeah, let me just put it right on the table. There was something that you said that we realized you weren't really working that hard to create your keyword list.
I'm really not.
And it was kind of funny because then you said in the same breath that you made, you know, up to 10 G's a month per niche. And honestly, compared to the keyword lists that I've seen from my students, and don't get me wrong, I understand that you have a huge process and a huge amount of patience that most newbies lack. And anyone who purchases your DVDs, which I strongly recommend for my students that are starting to experiment with surveying and market research at a higher level, who already have businesses online, and even though some of you who are niche mining and do that, but it's just very interesting to me, Glenn, that your keyword research is not like really the focus of your system. So when you really gear up the keyword research, it's going to put the system that you already have like on steroids.
I think that will, yeah.
And there's a contradiction that I'm looking at here because this is new. Like, really, honestly, no one's ever done what we're doing right now as far as software is concerned. And we actually literally had to flip over our sparse matrix. In other words, the way that we were looking at the long tail index. And when you look at the graphs on our walls and our whiteboards and stuff, you'll see a long tail wave, and then you'll see the inverse of it with other keywords converged. And we'll take the apex point or the convergence point of two different keywords and try to find out where the markets converge and then do research on those. And so we're looking at the whole long tail industry. But it was funny because your market intelligence is based on making sure that you have a high enough frequency of queries for a term before you'll even buy, because otherwise you don't have enough time to do market surveying on that term.
The reason why is that I was really looking to develop a secure and stable business, and it occurs to me that, sure, it's good to look for low-hanging fruit, to look for keywords that don't have a lot of competition, but if that's your real entry into the market, then...
Yeah, exactly. That's not a driver, and we agree with you. What I'm saying is that's interesting is that as we develop our system, which is Silo Architecture Market Intelligence Method, and as we also integrate the perpetual keyword traffic machine that we're kind of building with, we actually have a specific name for every type of keyword wherever it is in the process of what I call the perpetual keyword cycle. And again, these are just kind of silly names for trying to bring to market a system that keywords go through transformations in your process of conversion, and as far as when you should drill down into them and when they become something new. And what's interesting to me is that because in the survey process you're looking for the keywords that have a high frequency of traffic, a lot of things in the keyword list that I saw you brought up were not worthy of really doing survey on, and we would agree with that because you just wouldn't have enough time. You'd be waiting around for 6 months instead of what I think 3 months or 2 months is what you're willing to spend on that. But there's this huge list of what we call long tails that do not have high enough frequency query or they're not high enough traffic. In our model, what we do is, and this is the reason that ThemeZoom was basically built, because I was dealing with corporate clients who were spending $150,000 a month on AdWords. You know, they're paying $14 a click for certain words, but they were already number one and sometimes ranked more than once for terms across whole long tails and categories and themes for those terms that they were bidding on them twice. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but there was just, they had no choice because they didn't know. They couldn't keep track of all the data of what they were ranked highly for across all of their content and themes and what they were paying for. And what's interesting about that is if you take the long tails that really don't make sense to use in the survey and actually put them in an article or a content somewhere in your silo so that you're there, you're going to rank for them very, very quickly. And the most powerful thing that I walked away from watching your keyword stuff is that, and you talk about it as inversely proportional. In other words, the lower frequency or long tail terms, low frequency queries tend to have a higher response rate and or sometimes even conversion rate into a sale.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that makes sense then. And then I walked away with that saying, okay, well, long tail keywords and what we call expert verbiage at ThemeZoom are cumulative, meaning if they're high quality, they're on your site, you're going to rank for them very quickly if you've got them included in your article or in a silo or in your directory structure. And it's not that difficult to include some of these terms. Then your conversion across those terms, not using pay-per-click, not paying for those terms, is going to be pretty accumulative. You're going to start ranking highly across a lot of terms and concepts and themes that are expert verbiage and that are, you know, long-tailed to those niche-interested parties, and you're not even really going to need to pay for some of those terms. And meanwhile, you can test them in a silo structure, because we also teach siloing as far as pay-per-click and ad groups.
Right, so people who might hear this audio from other than ThemeZoom, could you just briefly explain what siloing is?
Yes, absolutely. And this is what I'm so excited to work with you, because you, ironically, have probably given the best description of siloing that I've ever heard. Siloing is something I learned from my SEO mentor, Bruce Clay.
Wow.
Yeah, Bruce Clay was my instructor for business optimization. I studied personally with him.
That's impressive.
Well, he's been out there for a while, and he's actually just a really terrific guy, and he just really understands data cubes, like the three-dimensional aspect of how everything's connected. And, you know, he owns the SEO toolset program, and he was one of the first SEOs out there. I learned a lot from him, and he was the first one really to invent the idea of the word silo. I mean, siloing is used in corporate America for other things, like the partitioning of departments and divisions and spreadsheets and using different Illustrator programs. And, you know, silos are considered the way to segment one scene from another. And there's also silo hierarchy and database technology and kind of geek speak where programmers use it. But in a nutshell, siloing is the way to distinguish one idea or concept from another. And in one of your videos, what you said about it has driven me to write a paper called The Child Psychology of Keyword Lists and Silos. And basically what you said is that the process of organizing keywords corresponds to the process of the development of thinking.
Yeah.
You can think of it in the way that a child develops their own thinking. For example, a baby. Like when children first start to learn how to think, they put things in very broad categories. So the first time they're exposed to something, for example, something that's fuzzy or furry, then they say doggy because that's what they associate it with. So everything has a dogness to it, right? I mean, I'm just giving my own. But basically you said that they'll point to anything, including a cat or a couch, and they'll say doggy. So they'll categorize everything under that single broad theme until their brain, until the neurogenesis of their growth has actually allowed them to understand the relationships of more specific or long-tail associations tied to that broad theme. They'll soon learn that cat is not dogness, and they'll have to create a new silo for cat in their brain. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. And so what you're trying to do in any market is the experience that you have whenever you're researching a new market is very much akin to the way the child feels,
mm-hmm.
in that you're first becoming exposed to all of these different keyword concepts and then kind of organizing them into categories and relationships.
Yes, exactly. And here's the crazy thing. It's not only the way that a child thinks or the way that we're trying to organize at Bruce Clay, it's kind of the way the universe works.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, mathematical algorithms, silo theory, and technical, especially the way that Google works in page ranking, and the way that they work with the Hilltop method, which has been pretty much mathematically proven to show that ranking and theme tend to be, there's a lot of controversy right now in the industry, but seems to pass through the site in general, through the topics and the hierarchy of the site. And some people are talking about it as more of a theme effect right now. But there's been a lot of movement towards recognizing that if you have a dog at the top of your category on your website, and everybody else on the web is using the word fuzzy or furry to talk about dogs, this is a cumulative effect called latent semantic indexing, along with what we are now coining as theme density, to kind of distinguish people who really know what they're talking about when they're referring to dog, and people who are still kind of trying to figure out if cat and dog are the same thing. That's what distinguishes a subject matter expert. Basically, silos are the things that keep your theme clear in a silo architecture and prevent you from bleeding ideas across different concepts. The more clear you are about what you're talking about and what your theme is, the more that Google seems to love you.
Got it. If I can just repeat back to you what I think I understand in English, is that if you do the work to develop a comprehensive, depthful keyword list, and you understand the way that those keywords are organized in the market, which keywords relate to other keywords, which belong in groups, which belong separately, and then you set up your site in such a way that it's clear to Google that you've got directories for those different groups of keywords, and the relationships between the directories match the search patterns that observing in the market themselves.
Correct.
Then you're going to rank much higher. Not only are you going to rank much higher because the psychology of your website, so to speak, is now going to match the natural way that people think about the market.
That's absolutely correct. High ranking, high traffic, high response, and highly qualified prospects can all be merged into a single concept, which is your actual sale.
Yep.
Never before has anyone really started talking efficiently, including us. We're still working on, which is why your work was so refreshing. How to efficiently educate the masses on that, what we call the great SEO contradiction, or the four contradictions, which is that somehow high ranking and high traffic, or what you call high frequency, aren't necessarily the same thing. But if there was a way to merge it all, it would be what we're calling the silo architecture method, or, you know, basically the silo architecture marketing intelligence method. You can do everything at once with great planning. You can do your technical layout of your site while you're also what I think Damon called trial by fire. That's why we've added a bid management system in there, because really you can dump a bunch of keywords, which we actually label and keep track of in the current software we're designing. We don't want to forget that the keywords that you're using in your pay-per-click campaign and testing are different than a keyword that's shown up in your weblog file. We actually keep a distinguished difference between those two until they become what we call the final holy grail of keywords, which is a money term, which means they've actually measurably snapshot created an actual sale. There's cash in your bank from that term.
Got it.
And that's trackable. And until it reaches that point, we don't change the name on the big board of that keyword.
Understandable, yes.
So it's a cycle that we actually watch everything. And I love the idea of trial by fire, and we call it a little bit different, but it really is that as soon as you have what we call high response keywords, either the click-through rate is high or even the conversion to sales is high, we'll drill into those and take the search engine proven synonyms and kind of create just a little bit of a faster way, we think, of coming up with some concepts and ideas for tightly grouped keywords lists around certain market segments. And if we have terms that do not have high enough frequency to warrant a huge survey project, then what we'll do is if we build our master site, we'll put the long tail on one of the lower pages in a directory in the silo just to make sure that we cover it and submit it to the search engine so that although we may not be paying for it in pay-per-click, we're darn sure going to get the traffic for it because we're probably one of the few people addressing it to the satisfaction of the market.
Got it. Russell, can I address a couple of things that you've discussed and try to integrate it with the survey methodology that I've been describing?
Yes, please.
Okay, the first one was the idea that when we add the theme zoom technology to keyword research, that we're going to wind up with a more comprehensive list with a lot of lower frequency terms that may not have enough traffic to survey in a reasonable time frame all by themselves. And yet, we still know that there is traffic on those keywords, and it's probably more responsive traffic because the longer tail, the
fascinating,
that the 3, 4, or 5 word phrases are probably people that are towards the end of the search continuum and closer to a buying decision.
Excellent. Right. That's it.
So the way that I will be integrating that to my process is, where possible, I will probably roll up those terms to their closest kissing cousin and survey them as part of a group, which is a small sacrifice in terms of the keyword-by-keyword intelligence that I like to have, but it gives me some understanding where I can of those terms.
Right.
Secondarily, if I've surveyed the height of the market curve, the more frequently searched terms, and I've got 40 or 50 of the more frequently searched terms and have a fairly thorough understanding of the search continuum from that, the odds are that if we add traffic nets vis-a-vis the long-tail keywords that come from your process, that we're going to be hitting 80 to 90% of the benefits that they're looking for anyway. So
yes,
it becomes a source of extra traffic that's going to a machine that's already converting better than everybody else is converting.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's fascinating, too, because we have to keep in mind for my users, Glenn, I just want to tell everyone at ThemeZoom, this is a market research method in as far as what Glenn is showing us. In other words, there's no website out there yet on the Internet usually, and maybe sometimes, but, you know, to even add natural content to. So what's interesting is, let's say you'd survey the market and you find out it's viable, you're going to have a massive list of compiled long tails that you can use later if you do decide to create a corporate site or a main site.
Yeah. The other concept that you talked about was the idea of trial by fire.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main principles that I've integrated into my methods is not wanting to get burned, because I'm primarily an advertiser, not a search engine optimizer.
Yeah, got it.
And I wanted to minimize risk, and losing $2 million, it was not fun.
I completely understand.
And so I found that when I run these surveys by keyword group, that the proportion of people that respond to the survey are indicative of what percent of people are going to be willing to sign up for a newsletter later on,
mm-hmm.
or fill out a lead generation form, which is indicative, mm-hmm. or at least proportional to the number of people that are going to eventually buy a product.
Right.
So, you know, because I can usually get 5% of the people who sign up for a newsletter to buy a product if I work the copy correctly. And so what that gives me is a metric, a measure, a percentage on every keyword as I'm doing the survey process before I invest the time to build a site, develop a product, and put more time and energy and resources into the campaign. It gives me the ability to figure out which pathways are likely to be most profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go through and I'll kill all the pathways that are looking least responsive. And that's the primary reason that I've been able to come through and have the hit rate that I've had, which is 85-90%
yep.
profitability.
Right.
Because I'm ruthless about killing the unprofitable pathways, and I might try them later out, you know, once I've got a profitable system.
It really is extraordinary that you're doing that. Again, all those numbers and formulas are in your package, right?
Oh, they are, sure.
I have one question for you. Are you bidding on multiple pay-per-click search engines, or are you only using one when you're doing your survey?
Up until early this year, I would only do the survey on Google, and sometimes I would syndicate it to the AOL and Earthlink and Google syndication partners, because I felt like that was the purest form of quality traffic I could find, and I was mm-hmm. experimenting with Overture traffic, and I felt that it was lower quality, less targeted. That's my experience with the survey, so I would kind of make the laboratory the Google environment. Google's PageRank algorithm has just trained all of the searchers that it's the most hyper-relevant place.
Yep.
So I find it's the best place to get a concentrated, focused burst of market intelligence.
Definitely.
More recently, as I'm going into much, much, much more competitive markets where I'm spending maybe $20,000 on a survey,
mm-hmm.
I'm taking the time and energy to separate all of the major pay-per-click engines and also separate content network traffic from regular pay-per-click traffic
uh-huh.
so I can determine whether there is a difference between them. I'm also doing things like recording the time of day and
time delineated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So short answer is that I've had my success rate based on Google alone, so I think it's the simplest thing to do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what I think is the most fascinating thing, because in my opinion, you're definitely the most prolific market intelligence guy out there as far as market research and niche mining. So I wouldn't even put you in the category of niche mining. It's kind of comprehensive what you do. To the themes and members, the real power to the system that I see is that you're really basing the idea of even creating a site at all or even pursuing the naturalized search on the response rate, or what we call the lower left quadrant of the four H's, which is the high response. If that response doesn't meet the formula that you've created, it's not worth even going after. And, of course, the proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the money being made. And when you hit it, you know, and you know you do. So I find that a really important concept that I want to train my teams and community on, so that instead of thinking in terms of just only high traffic, I want them to really be focusing more and more on high response.
Absolutely. It just makes sense in terms of risk management. And it was a necessity for me when, you know, I lost all that money and I was very deeply in debt behind the
mm-hmm.
And it was a real necessity for me, but then it became an obsession.
Another thing I'd like to also look at the end of your book, you have an overview of the whole process. Could you run down the entire process without compromising anything? I feel like we left a little bit of the whole Livingston survey process out of it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and, you know, the devil is always in the details. But
yeah, of course, and that's for sure with your stuff.
So you go through and you do your keyword research,
uh-huh.
and then you organize your keywords to the best of your ability by obsessively putting them into groups and going through many passes according to the child psychology development theory you mm-hmm. discussed before.
Okay.
Until the market makes intuitive sense to you and to the best of your ability, you think that you've organized them into meaningful keyword groups.
Right.
All the keyword groups have to have a good chance of producing 35 surveys a month. So my rule of thumb for that is to start with 2,000 searches. Every keyword group should represent 2,000 searches, but because lower frequency keyword groups get higher response rates, it's not really something you can be black and white about.
Right.
You have to adjust that when you get into the market. I'll make a brief mention that there's a corollary for doing this offline with any type of media. So I wouldn't want people to think it's just for online, but
right.
Your audience is so keyword focused, I'm really focusing on that today.
Mm-hmm.
And you set up AdWords that correspond to every group, AdWord groups that correspond to every keyword group.
Mm-hmm.
And you drive those to a separate survey page. It's really the same survey, but you code it in such a way that you know where the traffic came from.
Right.
You make a couple of changes to the page so that it's consistent with the keyword. And on that survey page, which should in some respect mimic your sales process, if you're planning to sell via a long direct response letter, then you should have a moderately sized direct response letter in your survey.
Okay.
You drive them to a survey, and I ask generally 6 or 7 questions. I've got a bunch of different types of surveys, and when you ask more questions, you get more intelligence, but you bias the sample only toward the absolute most interested people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find the best compromise is usually around 6 or 7 questions. And one of the questions is always the classic, please tell me the most important thing in your mind about guinea pigs or whatever the keyword is.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also ask them why. Why were they searching? Because if I know that a mother is searching about guinea pigs because her son's hamster died last week and she was only 6 years old and she wants to know how long guinea pigs live, yeah, it really provides you a much more powerful context for crafting the mood and tone of your message than if you just ask them what the most important question is.
Right.
I'll ask them how difficult it's been for them to find the answer. Now, this is a key point that everybody seems to miss.
Mm-hmm.
In general, if you look at how people conduct surveys and how they interpret them, they interpret them on a univariate level, which means that they think that the gold is in the questions themselves.
Right.
But the gold is not really in the question themselves. It's in the relationship between the questions.
Right.
So what I mean by that is that if you ask people, how difficult has it been for you to find this information?
Right. It's regression analysis.
Yeah, you can do a regression analysis, absolutely. That's the most powerful thing you can do, or among the most powerful things you can do, but on an even more simplistic level,
mm-hmm.
you can just pull out all the people that said the questions were difficult to find and focus on those and then see what they actually said.
Okay.
And that blasts right through, I think, the number one marketing illusion. And the number one marketing illusion is that the frequently asked question is the thing that should be the focus of your sale effort. And if you focus on frequently asked questions, what you're doing is you're focusing on what we call price of entry benefits, which are things that every competitor in the market has to have in their product offering in order to be even considered. But you're not focusing on point of difference benefits, which are the things that people are more likely to open up their wallets and pay money for.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a very big deal.
It's a huge deal, yeah.
It's a fundamental flaw in most survey them and then sell them methods.
Yep.
Because what happens frequently is the most frequently asked questions are things that are offered for free. People can find in the organic search listings on the first page of Google. And why are they going to pay money for that?
Of course.
So when I'm asking you about difficulty on the survey, I'm not only doing that because I want to gauge the overall difficulty and frustration level in the market, which I do, but I'm doing it because I want to be able to identify which questions are most difficult for people to answer, and that really helps me to prioritize my sales messaging. You know, and then I'll ask demographics, and if there's anything that I really know a priori in the market, you know, like, for example, in guinea pigs, it would be important to find out whether people have ever owned one before, whether they have one now, maybe how old their kids are or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're searching for themselves or searching for their kids, because it's much different to market to a 9-year-old boy versus marketing to his mother. By the way, I generally don't market to 9-year-old boys. So I ask a set of questions. It's not a very complex survey. It's the one-page survey, and I don't offer any incentive generally other than the answers to the questions they're looking for. So I'll tell them I'm writing a book, and I'll send them an electronic copy. If you were doing this in an existing business and you were selling cars, and you might offer them a extra $100 off a car if they buy them from you or something like that, or it should be a significant number. But the point is that you don't want to bias their intention, because if they got to the page by looking at a teaser ad that said everything you need to know about used cars, and then you offer them $100, not off of a used car, but you just offer them $100 to take the survey or even $10 to take the survey. Well, you don't know if they're taking the survey for the money or they're taking the survey because they really wanted the information. And you want your sample to be reflective of people who really wanted the information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So every keyword goes through a survey process like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or every keyword group goes through a survey process like that. And then I spend some time killing profitable pathways and examining the responses and making sure they're high enough quality to continue. And then I'll let the full survey run. I like to get a lot of responses because I do a lot of analysis on the back end.
Okay.
There's always trade-offs you can make if you don't have the money or time, but
right.
I prefer to have 1,000 people in my survey.
Sure.
And then when I analyze it, there's a lot of things that I do that other people don't. Try to do this quickly.
That's okay. You want to expound on those, break those down.
Okay. One of the first most important things that I do is called open-ended coding.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you that the gold in the survey is in the relationship between the questions.
Right.
If you've got this open-ended question, which is, you know, what's your most important question about a guinea pig, or what's your single biggest frustration in searching for a used car, well, people can answer anything they want to. And so it's hard to do a mathematical grouping and subgrouping and looking at percentages.
Right.
When you can't break that question down. So I've got a procedure for breaking down open-ended question like that into manageable number of categories for the answers.
Yes.
And then I look at which categories comprise what percent of the market and which categories are given by people who are having more difficulty finding the information. I'll look for people who left their phone number because...
Right.
If they'll leave their phone number, they're much more likely to want a relationship as an indication that the problem is of greater severity. If you're building a lead generation system and you're planning to do telemarketing to the people who fill out the form, then it's essential that you really focus on the people who leave their phone number in the survey because
right.
Otherwise what will happen is you build a lead generation form that will attract people who won't be receptive to telemarketing.
Right, exactly.
So I'll analyze that survey 6 ways to Sunday. I will cross-tabulate it. I'll break it up into different groups and subgroups. I spend a lot of time looking for hyper-responsive buyers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you know anything about the 80-20 rule and you kind of turn it in on itself, or anybody who's had any experience qualitatively in business knows that probably about half your profits in any business, when you do it correctly, come from maybe 1, 2, 3% of your buyers.
Yep.
So it's essential that you really understand and focus your sales and marketing efforts not on the market as a whole, but you really have a bias towards what the hyper-responsive people are going to want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll tag for hyper-responsive people by, for example, looking at everybody who left a long, detailed answer and gave me their phone number and said the information was hard to find.
Right.
This is one of the reasons I need to have so many people in the survey so I have a large enough number of hyper-responsive to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I've tagged the hyper-responsive questions, then I'll look to see what questions they're asking. I'll look to see what their demographics are. I will look to see if they belong to, you know, are they more of a guinea pig owner or the guinea pig prospect. And I'll find out everything I can possibly find out about the hyper-responsive people so that I can design sales processes specifically for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last very important thing that I do is I reverse engineer the search continuum. This is a key point that nobody really gets until they've studied it for a few hours, but I'll try to say it as simply as I can.
I'm all ears.
Okay. So we talked about the search continuum and how there's all these keywords and that flip side of those keywords, there are conversations in people's heads.
Yep.
Now, what you can do is when you ask people what their most important question is, when they've come through from a particular keyword like guinea pigs,
mm-hmm.
what you'll find is a certain percentage of them won't just give you one answer.
Right.
A lot of them will give you multiple utterances.
Uh-huh.
And if you've coded your answers for categories like I talked about,
mm-hmm.
what you can do is run a very simple statistic that you can find in a spreadsheet in your mm-hmm. Microsoft Excel, a little formula you can use there, and you can create a correlation matrix, which is nothing more than showing you the relationship between the categories. You can see which concerns stick together and which ones are propelled apart.
Got it.
And it's a very rudimentary way, but very effective way, of doing market segmentation. So it's not practical. Like in the ultimate ideal scenario, if you had the unlimited resources and time to put together a sales process, you would have one opt-in page and one sales letter and one follow-up sequence for every single keyword group.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's not practical to do that. So what you want to know is, what are the best compromises that I can make? And most marketers do this, if they do it at all, just by taking a qualitative understanding of what the different groups of people are.
Right.
But it's more effective and more accurate to look at the statistical relationships between the concerns that people are submitting so that you can kind of draw circles around, like in guinea pigs, you'll find there's a group of people that already own a guinea pig and need care for guinea pigs, and there's a group of people that are searching for information and really want to know, can they buy one for their kids, and there's a group of people that want to breed guinea pigs, and all these people have very distinct needs and concerns. And the reason this is so powerful, and one of the more powerful things that I've done, if you've had any experience marketing in Google, with Google AdWords, and you've broken things up into separate groups, and you realize that when you write a separate ad for a separate set of keywords, that you get a much higher response.
Yep.
The reason for that is that it increases the "this is exactly for me" response, and it decreases the frustration that people have in wading through irrelevant information.
Yep.
So if I don't have to bother the people that are searching for guinea pig breeding about how to build a guinea pig cage or how to take care of guinea pigs, you know, all the things they already know about,
yep,
their investment of time and energy is going to be so much less, and they're going to have the experience that I give them exactly what they want as quickly as they can possibly get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's worth taking the time and energy to analyze these surveys and do this kind of market segmentation, because what you think of as one market, I can almost certainly assure you, is more like three or four different segments, and you can dramatically boost your response if you can figure out what those segments are accurately and then set up a little traffic light and drive people into different sales streams based upon that.
That's really interesting, because what you're doing, which goes above and beyond keyword research or data mining altogether, you absolutely require feedback from the market itself. What I find interesting is then you actually had to create a process. That portion of it, what you call the Livingston Survey System, is...
Yeah, I'm calling the whole thing the Livingston Survey System as
right.
a whole. I wouldn't want to be grandiose and say that I've made up everything here.
You know, integrating it, I would say you have.
As a whole package, absolutely. But the coding of open-ended questions and cross-tabulating, I learned that when I was getting paid $100,000, $200,000 a project.
Yeah, sure.
For big companies, and that's been around for 50 years. And
you can't do anything unless you cross-tab, but what I find interesting is that the emotional aspects, I was laughing a little bit. It was pretty fun watching your videos and showing the categories and the questions and the open-ended stuff. You know, I think it probably takes some practice of figuring out where to stick the questions.
And the last part, which is actually extremely important, is all of this stuff, remember, fits into the category of what do people say is on their mind that they're looking for.
Right.
Now, the reason that this is better than just asking people in a supermarket or something what they're looking to shop for is that they've been pre-qualified as coming through an ad at a reasonable cost, making an effort to read a survey, and filling out a form.
Right.
But, and we're also going to later, when we launch, do testing and tracking in a more traditional way to find out what they do. But
mm-hmm.
before that, I want to move into the qualitative aspect of what people say. This has all been very quantitative. And it gives me a sense of the structure of the market and the size of the opportunities. And by measuring the percent of response to the surveys, it gives me a sense of where the market gaps are
mm-hmm.
and how big they are. And once I've got that structure and I have a fairly good sense of the segmentation of the market, what I want to do is go out and actually talk to the people who took the surveys in each segment.
Right.
So we'll do a little telephone group, and then I'll call them individually. I'll remind them about what they said. I'll hear the whole story about what they were looking for. I'll find out what happened since then. Did they make a purchase? What did they purchase? Why?
Mm-hmm.
What influenced that? And then I'll even do some guided imagery exercises to get a sense of what the real emotional benefits are behind the rational features and functions that they said they were looking for
mm-hmm.
so that I can really paint a picture and tell a story in my newsletters and sales letters. And
fascinating. So do you have a kind of a guideline for the percentage of people that you ended up calling as to the total volume of responses? the kind of intuitive, or you kind of know when you got it, when you figure out what the market's after, and you kind of know what the emotional problems or challenges or wants are.
I want to make sure I'm answering the right question. Could you ask it one more time?
Well, you said that you do pick up the phone and actually call and try to interface with the market. You didn't get a sense of how much calling you did to talk to people.
Oh, I see. Okay. This is the qualitative end of the process, so I want to talk to enough people in each segment until I feel like they're repeating themselves. I usually record the interviews, and when I get one interview that really, to me, represents a stereotypical person in that segment, and I feel like I can smell them and see them and know exactly what they want in their heart and their soul, then I usually stop interviewing in that segment. And the reason I do that is when I was studying copywriting, I learned that you always need to write to one person. So you go through this whole survey process, but when it comes down to it, you need to have that image in your mind to make sure that you're matching them with the tone. If you want a percentage, I will find that in good markets, maybe 10 to 15% of the people who take the survey will leave me their phone number, maybe 20%. If you get something that's way above that, then what that means is, first of all, that there's probably more frustration in the market and more desire, and you kind of get into something that could be a gold mine. But secondly, you should be integrating telephone into your marketing mix. I mean, you don't have to if you don't want to, but I've been finding lately that following up by phone in the actual marketing mix is response tripler. When you get a really high phone number fill-in in your survey, then that's an indication that these people want the contact and you're able to do that.
I got it. Wow, fascinating. Well, I have to say, definitely the most comprehensive, I don't even want to use the word niche mining. It's not isolated to that. So I've been talking about your stuff off and on in some of our calls briefly for the last couple months, so I know that my user base will be really excited to hear and see this. We're going to actually post a link. We very seldom cross-promote or do any third-party software, but because of the value and because of the alignment with the overall principles, we're going to go ahead and post a link for our user base to look at your webpage for those of you guys in TeamZoom who can afford it, especially if you're even remotely interested in purchasing a business. I know some of you have talked to me about visiting business brokerages, and some of you are just dabbling, and you've got money to spend in the business. I would recommend taking a look at everything in this video package. So do you have any more questions for us? Sure.
I could ask you questions for hours and hours and hours, but I think we did a good job for the call. I'd encourage people to go over to the site. There are hours of videos from the people who are actually at the seminar to get a sense of their experience. I guess the only other thing I'd want to say, Russell, is that people seem to have pegged me as the niche marketing guy and as the guy who you go to before you're going to start a new business or a new project.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really the way it is. I didn't want to come across that way.
Certainly, this is a wonderful thing to do before you roll out a product or start a new business, but if you've got an existing business and you're profitable or close to profitable, and especially if you've got an email list which can be surveyed just as easily as keywords can be surveyed and segmented the same way.
That's a good point.
If you add this intelligence to an existing business process, you really can double your profitability. You really can.
Can you give us an example of, you know, let's clear our palates from the whole niche mining AdSense rage, you know, that's out there with the idea of just how can I find a niche and make a bunch of money and all that kind of thing. I mean, I know you get some of those kinds of folks. But give me an example of someone who's got a successful business up and running, either on the Internet or
give me an example
of a business that's already intact.
Okay, so let's say that you've got 20,000 people on a house prospecting list, and you've got, let's say, 2,000 buyers, and maybe you're selling vitamins. Well, let's say all you have is the email address. A lot of times you'll have more than the email address, but let's say all you have is the email address.
Okay.
Well, the concerns and interests and frustrations and problems that people are experiencing in that email list probably could be segmented into a number of different categories. And what you could do is drive them to a survey and ask them their most important question about nutrition or vitamin supplements. And do your coding and find out how difficult it's been for them to find each of the answers. And what you'll wind up with is a prioritized list of concerns, and you'll see where the real opportunities are for monetizing that email list. And you'll figure out how you might be able to sublist those people so that one segment you'll find is interested in lowering their blood pressure, and another segment is interested in weight loss, and a third segment is interested in preventing macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know, you send out an email and you ask people, could they tell you which one of these three most represents their biggest interest in nutrition, and you put them all on sub lists according to their biggest interest, and now all of a sudden you've got three sub lists which are very specifically about their interest, and they're going to pay a lot more attention to those emails.
Right.
And you look at the specific concerns within those sub lists, and you develop sales copy around those concerns. You've got people paying more attention to your email, and then you're driving them to pages which are more specifically about what they're interested in to sell to them.
Instead of big branding. So what you're doing is you're using the same process to hone in on and create a more responsive market in the list that you might even already have.
Yeah. Now, Russ, if you've got a list of buyers and you have more information about them, like zip codes and phone number area codes and whatever other information you keep on your buyers, specific products that they've bought, and then you get the same kind of information about what their concerns and what else they're looking to buy, well, you can work it out so you tie all the information back together.
Yep.
So now you can not only segment your list by content concern, you know, what they're actually looking for,
yep,
but you can see whether there are any other variables in your database existing already that are predictive. So maybe you find that the people on the West Coast that are interested in preventing macular degeneration, and it's the people on the East Coast that are more interested in losing weight. I'm just making this up. And without even having to get them to go through another traffic light, now all of a sudden you can do a mailing to the West Coast people. And this is a situation where maybe it pays for you to not do an emailing, but since you know specifically what that group wants and you're only going to mail to the West Coast about macular degeneration and your likelihood of response is so much greater, maybe now you can make the economics work for a marketing method that wasn't previously viable. So, I mean, I can go on and on and on and on.
Well, okay, let's just wrap up the call with this final question. Let's just take a look at what's in the actual product that I received from you. Things may have changed. There's a huge amount of material. I'm still going through it. I had it for 2 months, and I'm still learning stuff. There's a lot of things in there. There's, like, files for your computer. There's Excel spreadsheets, you name it. That also is coupled with the question that I have that I've asked you offline, off the call, which is, you know, I'm always eager to automate as much as I can. I mean, that's just what I do. And I know some of these things require human intelligence. But first of all, tell me the stuff that I get in the package as far as if I really just did want to try your system online. I mean, obviously, do I have to write forms from scratch? Do I get assistance on sales copy? And, you know, in other words, what kind of tools are in that package right off the bat? And second of all, are you moving towards automating this process, or do you see the possibility of Beamzim in the future, including the Livingston survey process module or socket in our pay-per-click bid management system?
Sure. Sure. Well, I mean, that's actually kind of exciting to me. okay, the short answer is that you do get templates and guides and assistance so that you don't have to do everything from scratch. And there are outsourcing guides available to you so that, you know, if you want to use a one-page summary and post something in Elance to get a vendor to organize your keywords for you or to put the surveys up for you or set up your basic AdWords campaign, then you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see people go through it once by themselves because I always think you can manage vendors better.
Oh, definitely, and just through keyword research, too.
Yeah, but I was very cognizant of the fact that people don't want to do this by themselves time after time. So I made it all very modular, and I created an outsourcing guide, one or two pages for every module so that you can just hand it off to someone to delegate it.
Mm-hmm.
As we've had an influx of buyers and experience with people, they've been asking for services. It's been kind of hard for me to put it together because I make too much money if I were to do this myself, but I've started to work with a company to put together the human services that you'll need to do the coding. A machine can't really do the open-ended coding for you.
No.
There are algorithms that will try, but I find they're not really very effective. So.
No.
There are human processes that just can't be substituted, but I do have a trained team, and we will be providing that probably towards the summer of 07. We'll have that rolled out.
Excellent.
We're in some talks to consider automating the procedure, and maybe there's some way that you can join the talk circle. because everybody really wants the software that does what can be done for you. But everything here that I'm talking about, all the quantitative stuff, don't get scared by all of the fancy words that Russell and I threw around. If you can do your multiplications, your divides, your adds, and your subtracts, then you can work this out in a spreadsheet. And I actually have a module called Preparing the Report in a Spreadsheet, where I show you step-by-step how to take an Excel sheet and analyze it. So you really don't have to be scared of that. And you don't have to buy any other software when you're done. You can expect the system to be a comprehensive system, step-by-step with a flowchart that takes you from soup to nuts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was incredibly pleased with the actual manual that came with it, the summary, and even a follow-up. I think it was either a CD or a DVD that says, you know, let me recap everything. I think you even called it something like that. And I'm really pleased with it. Dr. Glenn, I've just had a really fantastic insight with this work, and I'll continue to expand on this. I'm hoping to get you back on a call for Themes and Numbers once I've had time to really dive deeper into what a union or a overlap between what you're doing and what we're doing will actually mean for our algorithm.
I would really look forward to that, and I feel like you've got a wealth of intelligence to educate me with. It would be as much of an honor for me to have the opportunity to talk to you again, too. So, of course.
Thank you. Okay, excellent. Thanks, folks. This is Russell Wright from ThemeZoom.com signing off. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for your time and attention. If you'd like to find out more about the comprehensive marketing research system I've used to succeed in market after market, please visit howtodoubleyourbusiness.com. That's howtodoubleyourbusiness.com.